Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you, of course, by globalresearch.ca. And today we're back again on a core topic on this program, the global economic crisis. It's grim. It's worsening. It's really going everywhere, just a giant tsunami. Call it an economic holocaust. It ain't getting any better, that is for sure. Today I'm delighted to have on John Bellamy Foster. John is the editor of Monthly Review, an important organization, an important website. They publish books. They have their own website. John is also a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, and he combines research on capitalism's economic, political, and ecological contradictions with teaching sociology, social theory, Marxism, and political economy. He's also written many articles. He's authored numerous books, and he has an important new one out now. He calls it the Great Financial Crisis, Causes and Consequences. Oh, great indeed it is, John. Let me welcome you to the program.
It's good to be here, Stephen.
Oh, I'm really delighted to have you on. Can I just mention a couple of things before we jump into your thoughts and the book
Yeah.
and so on? My co-host and editor of Global Research, Michelle Chostadelsky, also writes a lot on the global economic crisis. He calls his newest article, he refers to the Great Depression of the 21st century. Oh, he's got a stunning article with that title. And his newest article is top featured on the Global Research website. He calls it America's Fiscal Collapse. And he talks about the most drastic, it's really amazing to most people to grasp this and think about it. He talks about the most drastic curtailment in public spending in American history. Think about that. With all the trillions we're spending, the most drastic curtailment. And then he talks about a war budget. And he says austerity measures hitting all major federal spending programs except defense, militarism, foreign wars, the Wall Street bailout, a bottomless pit, multi-trillions, and the third category, the staggering interest payments on the far more staggering public debt. We really have a grim situation, and heaven knows where the people in charge, John, are going to lead us. But you wrote about it in your book, and we want to talk about that and your thoughts on what's going on. You're an economist, I'm not, but I read what important economists like you have to say, and then I write my own stuff as best as I can piece it together. In my mid-70s, John, it really scares the dickens out of me, and I guess it does you as well. But let me let you jump in with some thoughts.
Well, I was thinking about what you said in the beginning, about the severity of the crisis, and the World Bank came out with a statement a couple of days ago that said the world economy was going to sink. That is, in 2009, that there was actually going to be negative growth, not simply a drop in growth rate, but negative growth, which is absolutely astounding because in terms of the world economy, we define a world recession as something like a 2% rate of growth.
John, that
and,
music means, John, let me just break in. The music means a break is coming. Let's take that and then you can pick it right up when we get back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Foster. We're talking about his new book, The Great Financial Crisis. John, I love the cover of the book, and I want you to pick up where you left off. A picture of an individual, sort of an individual slash bull, with horns coming out of his head, sitting in a chair blowing bubbles, and he looks suspiciously like J.P. Morgan.
Hey, actually, it is J.P. Morgan. The picture was taken from Puck magazine from 1901.
Oh my goodness!
And the title, the original title, was Wall Street Bubbles, Always the Same, and that was the original title.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
it's 1901. Oh, I do love it. But I'll let you pick up where you left off. World Bank, and I think the IMF did the same thing, coming out with these grim statements.
Well, this is this was something new. This World Bank on Sunday came out with a statement that the entire world economy will shrink in 2009, and that's quite extraordinary, because before that, in the context of this crisis, they were saying, well, China's growth would continue to lead to a rise in the economy. And since the world economy as a whole has not shrunk since the 1930s, and we define a world recession, and which is considered to be a very severe global economic crisis, as something like 2%, a rate of growth in the world economy. Because there's always, usually there's always some part of the world economy that's growing. And, and so they were talking about the possibility or the likelihood of a world recession. Of course, it's obvious. But now, they're saying the whole world economy would shrink, will shrink from, for the first time since the 1930s. So that really makes it a world depression. And, there's no economy in the world that's immune to this, although the epicenter is in the United States.
And even a country like China that has had such explosive growth over the last couple of decades or so, it absolutely is not immune, because their economy, no matter what stimulus they apply at home, their economy is very heavily export-dependent, like Japan's.
Mm.
And you lose those markets, and you really, really take a big hit. I think the last number I saw on China, John, was, well, this might have been for February. Their exports were down 25% or more. And it seems to me that I read a quick line in one article that in Hong Kong alone, something like 3,000 factories shut down. I guess these are very small factories. I can't imagine 3,000 factories in one city.
Yeah, well, Asia is hit very hard. Japan is experienced a bigger slowdown, faster slowdown than the United States. And of course, for the Japanese, this is very alarming, because they had more than a decade of economic stagnation. It seemed like they were coming out of it, and now their economy has experienced this huge plunge. So this is a global crisis at this point. There's really nowhere to hide.
Oh, indeed, John. And Japan, we talk about Japan's lost decade. They've really had two lost decades. And I'm still stunned when people wonder, people have their savings in this country so heavily in the 401ks. And for the most part, I guess they're invested in stocks, which would really be the worst place in the world to have your money now, when even after the carnage in the equity markets, it's just a terribly risky place to be. You're playing Russian roulette, hoping all the bullets in the chamber are used up, but every time somebody thinks that's the case, it just seems to go lower. The rally of yesterday notwithstanding, that I never cease to be amazed, John, that a company that's just absolutely drowning in trillions of dollars of debt comes out and says it looks like we'll have a profitable first quarter, and the stock market goes crazy. Well, I guess it goes crazy till a piece of bad news comes out and it goes into reverse. But the losses to individuals have been so severe that I just can't imagine what people, especially elderly people who don't have a chance to make it up, what on earth are they going to do as they see their savings wiped away? For so many people, millions, their homes either lost or the threat of their being lost. And for working people, the jobs that are being lost. I've had two economists on this program, John Williams and Jack Rasmus. Jack Rasmus will be back next week.
John Williams, a statistician? Yeah.
He's got the Shadow Stats website.
Very interesting.
Oh, yeah. He reverse engineers the government data and comes up with his own. His latest figure for February is 899,000 jobs lost.
Uh-huh.
And his unemployment rate, if listeners are unfamiliar with it, I suggest they sit down. He's got it at 19.1% when discouraged workers and involuntary part-time workers are factored in. That's pretty staggering stuff.
Yeah, well, of course, the government itself has different unemployment measures, and the most inclusive is called U6, which includes the marginally attached or discouraged workers and part-time workers who are part-time for economic reasons. So he's building on that. The U6 measure, the government measure, says unemployment is 16%, I believe, at present in February 2008. So that's the wider unemployment figure. And John Williams figures those numbers are a little bit too low, but his numbers are controversial, but I think he's closer to the mark. I look at what's called the jobless rate, and the unemployment rate at currently is the official unemployment rate is 8.1%, and it's not a very good marker of the level of unemployment in the economy because for a number of reasons. But there's what we call the jobless rate, and that says that basically measures the number of the percentage of prime age workers or people between 25 and 54 who are jobless. And so it's much more encompassing than the unemployment figures, which are based on notions of who belongs into the labor market. The jobless rate just looks at the percentage of prime age individuals 25 to 54 who don't have jobs. And it used to be that the unemployment rate and the jobless rate fluctuated very closely, but beginning in 1980, they started going in different directions, with the unemployment rate going up, down, and the jobless rate going up. So there is now a huge gap. And the jobless rate now for men is 19%, and the jobless rate for men and women is 23%. And if we look at the gap between the unemployment rate and the jobless rate, the jobless rate is 11 points higher than the unemployment rate now, and it was only 6% percentage points higher than the unemployment rate in the mid-1970s. So there's a kind of a distortion, and the unemployment figures don't really tell you the number of people that really are jobless in the economy. And just one other figure on this that might give you an idea. In 1948, the jobless rate for men was 6% as compared to 19%. In 2009. So that's a 13 percentage point difference in the jobless rate. It's 13 percentage points higher in 2009 than it was in 1948. So people are really hurting, and we need to begin to understand that.
Of course, anybody who loses a job realize they don't care about the unemployment rate. They just know they need work and they don't have it. But
there are more and more people like that. And what we have is the hidden unemployed is the problem. People who are so now discouraged, so many people who are in such bad shape, they've basically dropped out of labor, out of the labor force and out of the unemployment figures. So when they bandy around these figures of 8%, you have to understand 8% unemployment, that it's a distortion, and that we're much closer to the kinds of levels of unemployment we saw in the Great Depression than people realize.
The top figure in the Great Depression was 25%, but John Williams made a comment that very possibly that figure was higher. And I just checked I don't know what the specific number was in the 1930s, but agriculture as a percent of the economy was about a third,
mm-hmm.
either a third or a quarter, I forget the number. And farmers, just plain old ordinary farmers, not agribusiness, but ordinary farmers, were a substantial portion of the population. Today, those farmers represent less than 2% of workers. So we talk about non-farm payrolls. So non-farm payrolls then and today were two different animals entirely.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
John, I apologize. The breaks, I think at a given moment in time when the clock ticks, whatever, zap. we're off and the commercial is on, but we're back on again, and I'll let you pick up where you left off.
Oh, I was just responding to what you were saying in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I think John Williams talks about this on his latest newsletter. Says that non-farm unemployment in the Great Depression was about 34%. So it was considerably higher than in the Great Depression. And it's also interesting that during the Depression, a lot of people who were unemployed went back to their family farms because the farm sector was still a big part of the economy. But now the unemployed don't really have that recourse. People don't have family farms to go back to. They can't live on the land the way they could before. And so this creates more suffering in some respects.
John, I even remember, I'm old enough to remember World War II. And one of the things that went on, I mean, I was a city boy, so there were no farms anywhere near where I lived. But we had victory gardens back then. People were encouraged to do a lot of things because we were in World War II. So, you know, turn in your used, the ones you're not using, your used aluminum pots and pans for the war effort. And if you're able, grow victory gardens. There were a lot of victory gardens, and none on my block, but there were. I grew up in Boston. And I think you could get outside of the city limits and you could find victory gardens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anything like that now. And if we were encouraged to plant gardens and grow our own food, my goodness, people would just throw their hands in the air and not know what to do.
Yeah, they'd throw their hands in the air. But, of course, getting back to a more ecological society, that would be the thing to do. It's what they're doing in some countries in the world. And Cuba, people are growing their more own food and becoming more food self-sufficient, which would be a good thing. There are good things that can come out of crises as well as bad.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, today we're at the mercy of agribusiness. And we've had discussions on this program about how their aim is to make all foods genetically modified, and this stuff is pure poison. Bill Engdahl, an economist who also writes about agribusiness, and he has a book called Seeds of Destruction, we've discussed on this program. Oh, I mean, these people are predators. They're papering the earth with this stuff. And I go out of my way to avoid it. But imagine if we could have good, clean, wholesome food. Oh, I actually forgot, John. My landlord, as a boy growing up, we lived in a three-family house. And our landlord, two aging Italian couples, lovely people, and we had a big backyard. And in the summertime, they had a garden. And they planted the tomatoes and other vegetables. Oh, my goodness, I forgot about that. And they would give us some, and I can still remember a tomato that tasted like a tomato.
Yeah, not the synthetic things they have now. Well, we genetically alter them and apply chemicals to them because people have been shown to buy things more readily if they look like plastic.
Indeed. And boy, does it taste awful.
Yeah.
I think if we can accommodate ourselves at farmers markets, and thankfully we do have them around Chicago, and in the summertime they come on out and they harvest their stuff the night before and set up shop. I go out on a Saturday to one, and I can buy vegetables that taste like vegetables, and then when they close up shop at the end of the – they stay till late October – And when they're gone, I have to go back to the market and buy their stuff. I mean, to me, it tastes like I'm eating a plastic bag or a paper bag.
Yeah, well, there is a world food crisis going on now, too. And this was a major concern in 2007, 2008, and we should be concerned about it today. There's been a massive growth in the last couple of years in world hunger. We're doing a summer issue and month review on this. This is one of the areas that we work in. I edited a book called Hungry for Profit at one point. But if you look at the United States right now, they're at least in 2007, and I know it's much worse now, but I don't have the most recent figures, but I think it was late 2007 that it might have been 2008, where they declared that 12% of the population was in the United States was food insecure. They banned the word hunger, I think, under the Bush administration to deal with these issues in the United States. So we don't say that people are hungry. We say that they're food insecure. But a very significant percentage of the U.S. population is food insecure or hungry, and those numbers are growing very rapidly right now.
Well, John, I know that here in Chicago, I live downtown in the city, and public housing is not all that far from where I am, maybe a mile or so. I mean, I could walk over to a very poor public housing area and find people who literally are hungry, kids that don't get fed right. And here, again, in the richest country in the world, this kind of stuff goes on. It really is a disgrace. Let's continue on that as soon as we come back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Back to the News Hour. I'm on with John Bellamy Foster. We're talking about the economy, the crisis, related areas. John, I just pulled up a monthly review's website. I do want to stress that to listeners because you do extraordinary work, and they can find it easily just by Googling monthly review, but it's monthlyreview.org, and you've got an article up now. I believe I'm in the most current spot. A failed system, the world crisis of capitalist globalization and its impact on China. You wrote it. And it's got information on your book about the great financial crisis, Monthly Review Press. You do terrific work, John. You really have an extraordinary operation, I must say.
Well, thank you. It's a magazine that Monthly Review started with a magazine that dates back to 1949, and Albert Einstein wrote an article for the first issue.
Oh, my goodness. That is a collector's item.
Yeah. Well, we'll reprint that article in our 60th anniversary issue in May.
Oh, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Well, unfortunately, I cannot get Albert on this program. Much as I wish we could, we could go back in time and do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you were talking about high food prices, and indeed, I wrote a little bit about it myself in one article that it was causing just immense problems, especially in developed countries. And I spent a little bit of time on Haiti and how people down, the most impoverished country in the hemisphere, and how people down there need to eat something called mud cookies. If anybody can imagine this stuff, it's some kind of edible mud. But it's not something that any of us want on a lunch or dinner table. You don't want to eat this stuff. And there's a lot of bacterial contamination. And, of course, the stuff is pretty devoid of any nutrition. So it might fill your stomach, but you can get a disease, and you'll be nutritionally deficient. So Haiti's affected. All kinds of countries are affected by this.
There are all sorts of things that go into the world hunger crisis that we're having now. One of the things was a shift in towards production of biofuels, right? So if you more agricultural land is being devoted to providing fuel for automobiles and less devoted to producing food. So if the amount of if you produce ethanol for automobiles, if you fill up one SUV, the tank of one SUV, that uses up as enough corn to feed 8 people for a year, just that one tank load.
And it's a scam, John.
So we have all of these distortions occurring in our priorities.
It's shocking. It's a scam. And to think that corn that's needed to feed hungry people, instead we want to turn it into gasoline. And we're not really solving any environmental problem by doing this. We're changing policy and creating a bigger problem than the problem we say we want to solve. Well, I think one of them, way back in one of Bill Engel's books, he talks about going back to the Rockefellers, one member of the family, believing in eugenics, and Henry Kissinger being involved, and he had some kind of a memorandum, NSM, with a number behind it. I forget the number, 3300 or something or other. It was really a plan to cull world population, to literally reduce the world population. Now, you can't go out and shoot them. You can't bomb them. You can't machine gun them to death. So you can starve them to death. I remember something, I believe it was in Brazil, where unknown to many, many women, in the many thousands, they were sterilized so they couldn't have kids. Mm-hmm. So this is the plot of people like the Rockefeller family going back many decades. And our Nobel laureate, Henry Kissinger, was involved in this kind of plot. And heaven knows what they're doing right now, John.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how the rich have always tended to see the poor as the enemy, and so these kinds of Malthusian notions have been constantly promoted. But mentioning Rockefeller and mentioning a rich person's wealth, it makes me think of something I was looking at today in terms of Bill Gates. In 1999, his wealth was equal to that of 226 million, the income of 226 million people in Africa, the GDP of about 10 countries. And you wonder with the amount of hunger and you know, the destitution in the world, why one individual ends up starting to have an income equal to maybe a a large percentage of a whole continent. It's extraordinary, and the inequality in the world today is beyond all imagination. And in the United States itself, you have a situation where 1% of the top 1% of the wealth holders own more than twice what the bottom 80% of the population owns. So the wealth of the top 1% in the United States exceeds the wealth of the bottom 80%. And if you look just at financial wealth, the top 1%, its wealth is four times as much as the bottom 80%. Twice as much as the bottom 80% if you include houses, basically. Four times the bottom 80% if you don't include houses.
In your book, John, in your writings, you talk about and how true the rise of the financial industry in the country, of financialization, and how it just grew to a very strong percentage of the economy, and for the most part, not productive, not making anything. As the economy of making stuff declined, the economy of speculation just skyrocketed. So you've got major banks, the ones in so much trouble now. You've got major banks that really don't function like banks anymore, except how they did enslave foreign countries. But the rest of what they do is run a casino, or run a hedge fund, and they pile up all of these debts. And the game, or the Ponzi scheme, whatever you want to call it, it works great until it stops working. And of course, in 2007, it stopped working. Last year, it collapsed. And I suspect that the worst may be yet to come as things keep going down and down and down. And a bank like Citigroup can say we're going to have a very profitable quarter. Well, it's very easy to do that, John, when you just report your operating earnings and forget about all the stuff that either you've written off but you don't count, or that you haven't written off that you don't want to talk about. And that category, we're talking about trillions of dollars of toxic debt that maybe they feel, John, if they don't say anything about it, the people will forget about it. It'll just go away. But it's still there, trillions of dollars.
Well, a couple of different problems here. I mean, serious problems. We have such a severe economic crisis now, and this isn't anywhere near resembling the kinds of recessions that have existed throughout the post-Second World War period. What we have is a crisis in which long-term factors are at work. Long-term factors that are coming into play, and not just the ordinary business cycle. And the way to understand this, I think, is, of course, it's obvious to everyone, I think, now that there was a long-term process of the financialization of the U.S. economy, where the economy relied more and more on debt and the piling up of debt and speculation as a way of promoting growth, and that's now collapsing. There's what you could call a mean reversion to the underlying economy, which has been growing at a very slow rate. So the financialization is that whole process of the building up of debt and speculation is now coming down, and we're being forced back into the reality of what is underneath quite a stagnant economy. And I think it's a mistake to see the financialization as the real problem. The real problem is the slowing down of the underlying economy, or stagnation. If we look back to the early 1970s, we could see that the drop-off in the rate of growth, the slowing down of the economy, and the economy grew more slowly in the United States and also the world economy as a whole in the 1970s, as opposed to, it was slower in the 1970s than in the 60s, slower in the 1980s and 90s than in the 1970s, and slower in the 2000s up to 2007 than in the 1990s. And, of course, the rate of growth now has fallen off a cliff. So the economy has been slowing down. And I think the underlying problem is that the economy has been generating more profits and surplus than they've been able to reinvest in productive investment, and because of all sorts of structural problems that are preventing investment, the biggest problem of all is that real wages have stagnated since the 1970s. So they real wages peaked in 1972 and have now fallen back to the 1967 level when Lyndon Johnson was president. So real wages are now no higher than they were when Lyndon Johnson was president, despite all the growth and wealth and productivity and profit since. And so that means consumption was depressed, and people were only able to maintain consumption by building up debt, and underlying conditions for investment in such an economy weren't that good. The owners of capital decided to use the surplus that they were that was being generated, and that was the surplus capital in their hands, and pour it into the financial sector where they could get higher returns. And this lifted the economy for a couple of decades. But now it's all crashed, and we're faced back with this underlying problem of stagnation that seems like it is going to persist for a long time. Even after we come out of the actual downturn, it's likely that we're going to have a very slow growth for at least a decade.
Oh, John, I absolutely agree with that. I hope the worst of it is slow growth after things settle down. We're still very much in a downturn that has all the earmarks of a depression. But I hope when the dust settles, we can talk about stagnant growth. But when people, there was a point I was going to make earlier, and I lost my train of thought, or I jumped to another point. But if people worry about their savings and their investments, they should think about what happened to Japan. And I'm struck that the Japanese stock market, the main average, the Nikkei, on the last trading day of 1989, it peaked just under 39,000. And I don't know what it did yesterday, but a day or two ago, it was down around the 7,000 level. I mean, just imagine that. I mean, that's well, from 1939 to 1932, our market, the Dow, lost 89%. So the Japanese market, I mean, it's well over an 80% loss running over a 20-year period.
Yeah, I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times a couple of days ago, or at least in the, you know, financial press, where they said that people who had had retirement savings at the peak in Japan in 1989, 1990, and the financial crash occurred there and the stagnation. People were told, well, they just hold on to their investments, their retirement accounts, and that it would go back up and they would be able to retire on the basis of that. But now, in 2009, those investments would only be worth 25% of what they were worth at the peak in 1989-1990. So people are suffering enormously because especially if it's retirement savings, and this is what people were depending on for their future.
And, of course, the point is the exact same thing can happen here. It did in the early 1930s, and then after a recovery, it did again in the later 1930s. And it took a world war to bail us out and return prosperity. Heaven help us if we get a world war now. there may not be a chance to have prosperity if that happens.
There's a less dismal conclusion that I sometimes talk to people about. And, of course, in terms of getting out of this stagnation, it's very ominous that the United States didn't recover from the Great Depression, really. It just merged into the Second World War, and that solved the problem. But we don't want that kind of outcome. We can't afford a third world war. The United States is already spending as much on the military as all the other countries in the world put together, and we can't afford to increase military spending. But there is something else that I think we should talk about, and that is in the 1930s, people actually responded and organized in response to the very deep depression. Economy, as we mentioned, hit bottom in 1933 and at 25% unemployment, and then the recovery began. And not long after the recovery began, in 1934, you had the great strike wave in the United States. You had this enormous class struggle, revolt from below. The creation of the industrial union, movement, pitched battles all over.
Oh, indeed, John, we have to break again. Welcome back. John, the hour always flies by so fast. I leave each program wishing I had a second hour because there's so much more we can talk about. I hope you'll come back and we can do this again.
Yes, it would be wonderful. I was just saying that we need to remember the great revolt from below in 1934 and the creation of the CIO and the Second New Deal and all the great movements that occurred in the 1930s. We can do it again.
Oh, absolutely. The National Labor Relations Board, the Wagner Act, the greatest labor legislation that ever since they dismantled piece by piece. We need to resurrect it.
Yeah, so there's ways to move forward in this crisis.
Oh, indeed there is. We need activist people, John. We just don't have enough. I think there's a lot of local stuff going on, but we need people as energized and activists as they got back in the 30s. And I think the Roosevelt administration really got scared that they darn well better do something or this thing is going to grow and it'll get out of hand. And they don't know what to do. They didn't have the battalions of Marines that they have now. So we actually got something done.
Yeah, well, I think that if you have mass movements, we can get things done. We have to remember our history, that people, the older people have to talk to the younger people. The workers have to get together with the students. Environmentalists need to get together with people who are struggling over the economy. And we need to create a big mass movement where our common ground is forged.
John, there's no question. Our history shows that when there's enough activism at the grassroots, change can happen. And we got labor reform, we got civil rights, and by God, we did the impossible. We ended slavery. That was impossible, but it was done. So why the devil can't we make changes happen now?
I keep telling people to remember 1934 because that's when the big revolt occurred in the Great Depression in the United States, and it was a year after the crisis. The economy hit bottom. It was 4 years into the Depression before the movement really took off. If you don't see anything happening right now, you shouldn't become too pessimistic about it because people are talking and organizing and thinking and actions are beginning. In 3 or 4 years under these circumstances, we're going to see a lot of struggles.
And they need to listen to programs like this, John, because they'll give good information, and I hope we'll inspire them to do exactly what you're talking about. It's in our own interest, and if we don't help ourselves, well, who will? And when enough of us try to help ourselves, it's impossible for the government not to hear it.
Yeah, well, right now, $10 trillion have been given in support programs, mainly to the financial sector by the government since the crisis started. And the country is being robbed blind. Most people don't even really understand the dimensions of it. And this is our tax dollars that are going, I think, to the wrong end.
Oh, there's no question about it. The guys who caused the problem are getting rewarded for the crimes that they committed. And it's more than an outrage, John. I mean, this thing is so outrageous that people really do need to understand just what's going on and to get mad enough to want to do something. Well, millions of people losing their jobs, losing their homes, and getting crumbs and help. The suffering is going to be immense before this thing ends.
They dropped from the stimulus package the $40 billion for repairing schools. They said we couldn't afford it. $160 billion was given to Bank of America alone in terms of capital.
Indeed, John. John, they're just about to cut us off and break away for the next program. I've just got time to thank you for coming on, and I do hope you'll come back and we can do this again.
Yes, I would like to. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. I welcome listeners to come back tomorrow. We'll have another live program, a very interesting one. I'll keep you in suspense. But come back tomorrow, and we'll be back on live. Till then.
All right.